Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin here from Miami. Richard Martin's wake-up call coming to you this holiday Monday. Some of you presumably will be at home. Others will be listening on archives later in the day or in the week. This is a day when Great Britain decided that it would try again. It had originally created a bailout for its citizens last year, and manifestly, patently, it did not work. So they're going to try again today with another one. And this came at the same time as an email that I received from Frank Devlin with a really very perceptive article from someone called Kristin Jensen, who writes for Bloomberg. And I was so impressed with the article that I thought I would read it to you in full, because it really does express the absurdity of these bailouts. It has nothing to do with politics whatsoever, but it does nevertheless paint the futile situation in which these governments find themselves now with these bailouts. So this is the article. It's from Bloomberg, written on January the 18th, which was yesterday. When Barack Obama gives his inaugural address on January the 20th, he will evoke the inspiration of John F. Kennedy, the dreams of Martin Luther King Jr., and the challenges that faced Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The nation's first black president is also expected to pay homage to a predecessor he often cites, Abraham Lincoln. Like Lincoln, Obama rose to prominence largely because of rhetorical skills. And like other American orators in history, Obama is now charged with offering reassurance to a shaken population. The address has to, quote, restore the confidence of American consumers and investors in their own leadership and country, said Kennedy's speechwriter Ted Sorensen in an interview. Quote again. It's got to restore the confidence of foreign investors and leaders in this country. End quote. I voted for Barack Obama. I am thrilled that the citizens of the USA courageously elected an African-American man as our 44th president. I believe that Barack Obama is a fine man, a loving father, and a rigorous scholar. Regardless of these feelings, I will not watch the inauguration on Tuesday. Why? Because I believe that false hope is a dangerous thing. All of the emotions and excitement and deeply moving moments that will characterize the inauguration will stand in brutally stark contrast to the disastrous economic realities unfolding daily. Tears of joy and heartfelt cheers will quickly fade as the Obama team prepares to embark upon the ill-fated and patently insane economic policy of creating bad banks to buy up all of our banks' toxic assets. Those who have traveled from all over the nation to take part in a weekend of celebration to be part of history will return home to growing unemployment and sinking property values and spiraling deflation and growing desperation. And frankly, no amount of joy and optimism will overcome the economic tragedy to come. Now, many will read this post and think that I'm just a party pooper, a negative Ned. Let me clarify in 5 points. 1. Restoring the confidence of American consumers so that they can go further into debt servitude is criminal. And that is precisely what Mr. Sorensen is promoting. And the Obama-Rubin-Summers triumvirate's creation of bad banks to buy up all of the bad assets in the country is not just criminal, it is criminally insane. These bad banks are going to have to spend literally tens of trillions of dollars to accomplish the goal of buying up all of the toxic assets held by these banks. Because for every billion in toilet paper reported by these institutions, there's another 50 billion hidden away from public view. How do I know this, you ask? Well, just take a look at Citigroup and Bank of America. How much have we spent to begin the process of saving just two institutions? Let's conservatively say $500 billion. Now multiply that number by, we'll say, 5, a very conservative estimate. 5 being the multiplier that accounts for all of Bank of America and Citigroup's debt. Now multiply that number by 100, again conservatively, a multiplier that represents the proportion of total debt held by Citigroup and Bank of America in relation to the nation's other financials. The total? Roughly $25 trillion. At what point do the bad banks, the government, implode under the weight of this debt glacier? Point two. Spending $50 million on an inauguration celebration while hunger and homelessness grow by the hour is wrong. And for those who make the argument that $50 million spent means $50 million to carpenters and caterers and musicians and policemen, you have missed the point altogether. Not 1 cent of those $50 million is going to produce anything that can become part of the real GNP. It's all just consumerist crapola. The lavishly decorated stage will be taken down on Wednesday. The tons of sugar-saturated food will be either devoured or thrown into the garbage. The policemen and other security personnel will take their overtime pay and sock it away because they're all in debt up to their badges, etc. On Wednesday, there will be nothing to show for the events because nothing was, in fact, produced by the event. This, by the way, is a perfect example of the myth of GDP that has been proffered by our political and financial leaders for decades. Growth, as a measure of debt or of non-circulating monies or of goods and services that have no ancillary or subsequent derivational value, is not real growth. It is the illusion of growth, an illusion perpetuated by the ruling classes for their benefit alone. Point three. Tens of thousands of middle-class and working-class participants in the weekend festivities, all of whom are just dying to be part of history, will return home not just thousands of dollars poorer, but thousands of dollars further in debt, having produced and or purchased nothing of utility. Point four. The audacity of false hope is that people will smilingly follow Obama down the river Styx as he institutes fatally flawed economic policies. All of the world's financial institutions are hiding trillions in worthless assets behind their vault doors. Hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of garbage, just waiting to be exposed. Every bank is insolvent. Every state, every municipality also broke. The age of credit is over. The bad bank purchase plan is simply more trillions down the drain. Point five. While I know that it is tempting, please do not compare this moment to that during which Martin Luther King Jr. gave his defining "I Have a Dream" speech. We stand at the cusp of the most dramatic global economic dislocation in history. The aforementioned moment in history did in fact have lasting and decidedly positive impact on the nation. Martin Luther King's speech was a critical and defining moment during a grand movement for political and social equality. Barack Obama's inauguration is not such a moment. It is a moment that marks a transition from one regime to another. Unfortunately, the Obama regime seems ready to promote economic policies that simply continue us on the road to perdition rather than rescuing us from the abyss. In my opinion, Barack Obama should have cancelled the inauguration celebration, redirected all of the money set aside for the events to food banks around the nation, and modeled for the nation the sobering realities that we face. Instead, he has chosen a grand and glorious wedding rather than a quiet marriage in front of a justice of the peace. He has opted for the $10,000 wedding ring rather than weaving blades of grass together into a wedding band. He has baked a cake for 1 million wedding invitees, a lovely frosting-encased edifice that has no nutritional value for the country. And once the grand wedding is over, all of the drunk celebrants will return home and wake up on Wednesday morning with hangovers and less money in the bank and will scratch their heads and wonder what happens next. Truth be known, I believe in time the festivities of the inauguration will serve to undermine Obama's authority during this, the most trying moment in American history. People will recall the smiles and good feelings, and they will wonder aloud, what the hell were we thinking? Had Barack Obama opted for a more understated and somber inauguration, people might have been jolted out of their somnambulant complacency. Unfortunately, while the rest of the nation batters down the hatches, it's party time in Washington. Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, thanks to Frank Devlin for that. And, of course, thanks to Kirsten Jensen of Bloomberg. I think it goes without saying that I agree with every word. Okay. This is Richard Martin. Richard Martin's wake-up call coming to you from Miami, Florida, through the offices of the Progressive Radio Network in New York City. You may call them and ask a question right now on the toll-free number at PRN, which is 888-873-4643. Once more, the toll-free number for you to ask your questions live right now on the show is 888-873-4643. If you would like to email in your question to me instead of sending it by voice over the toll-free number, you can do that too. And in order to do that, you should please write to rmartin@latamenv.com. That's LATAMINV, which is short for Latin American Investments, LATAMINV.com. Once more, the email address, rmartin@lataminv.com. Finally, if you would like to call me in person at any time during the week, you may do that too, to ask your private questions about your finances, etc., by calling me on my direct line at 305-579-2012. Once again, 305-579-2012. All right. Well, you may remember on my landmark speech of the 5th of January, I mentioned a publication called the Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin, and they have just come out with another bulletin called "The Sequence of Global Insolvency Begins." Basically, what they're saying is, in 2007, Leap E2020 announced that U.S. banks and consumers were both insolvent. More than a year ago, our team estimated that $10,000 billion worth in ghost assets would vanish in the crisis. $10,000 billion, I think that's what in Europe they call $10 trillion, I believe. Both announcements came in complete opposition with the common opinion of that time. However, they proved perfectly justified in the months after. In the same line, Leap E2020 today estimates that a new sequence of the fourth phase, so-called decanting phase, of the unfolding global systemic crisis has begun, the sequence of global insolvency. Well, ladies and gentlemen, these are very profound thoughts. They represent just about the worst possible economic prediction anybody could make. In economic terms, I think it can be compared to a nuclear holocaust. It couldn't be worse, frankly. And to have the organization as prestigious as Leap come out with this is truly earth-shattering. You know, contrary to what political leaders and their central bankers seem to believe worldwide, the problem of liquidity that they are trying to solve by means of historic interest rate drops and unlimited money creation is not a cause, but it is a consequence of the current crisis. It is, as I've said so many times in the last few years, a problem of solvency, which is digging black holes where liquidities disappear, whether we call these black holes balance sheets or household debt or corporate bankruptcies or public deficits. They are all a problem of solvency. They are not a problem of liquidity, which is what your government wants you to believe, whichever country you come from. You know, considering that a conservative estimation of these ghost assets reaches $30,000 billion or $30 trillion, the world is clearly now facing a situation of general insolvency affecting, in the first place, the most indebted countries and organizations, whether public or private, and or those depending most on financial services. The difference between a crisis of liquidity and a crisis of solvency can appear rather technical, and in the end, not particularly decisive concerning the evolution of the current crisis. However, it's not a simple academic dispute. Indeed, according to the answer to that question, the actions taken by governments and central banks will either be useful or utterly useless, if not dangerous. Well, let's take a simple example to help us understand what's at stake. If you as a person meet a temporary problem of cash, and if your bank or your family agrees to lend you the money you need to cross over that difficult path, their effort is mutually beneficial. Indeed, you can resume your activity, you can pay your employees and yourself, your bank or your family get their money back, with interest, of course, in the case of the bank, and the economy in general benefited from a positive contribution. But if your problem is not due to a question of cash flow, but to the fact that your activity has ceased to be profitable and will never be again because of new economic conditions, then the effort made by your bank or family becomes all the more dangerous that it was substantial. Indeed, in all likelihood, your first call for funds will soon be followed by more calls, always matched with promises, honest ones, we suppose, that difficult times are about to be over. The more your bank or your family has lent you, and therefore the more it would lose if your activity is stopped, the more willing they will be to continue helping you. However, if the situation worsens, and it will if it comes from a problem of profitability, there is a moment when the limits are reached. On the one hand, your bank will decide that there is more to lose in keeping supporting you than in letting you down. On the other hand, your family ends up with no money left because you've siphoned its entire savings. Then it appears clearly to everyone not only that you are insolvent or bankrupt, but that you drag down with you your family and or your bank. You have thus dealt a severe blow on the economy around you, including your close relatives. It's important to realize the fact that all this can take place in all sincerity because you are not aware of the impact on your activity of a sudden change in the economic context, disrupting the conditions of your profitability. This is the situation prevailing today throughout the entire global financial system. A large part of the world economy and all the economic players, including the United States, who based their growth on debt in the past years. The crisis translates and magnifies a problem of global insolvency. The world is becoming aware of the fact that it is a lot poorer than it used to believe in the last decade. And 2009 is the year when all the economic players must try to assess their real level of solvency, knowing that many assets are still losing value. Moreover, a growing number of investors no longer trust the traditional investments and indicators of measurement. Quoting agencies have lost all credibility. The US dollar is just a fiction of international monetary unit, and many countries are striving to get away from it as quickly as possible. Thus, quite rightly, the entire financial sphere is suspected of being a giant black hole. Concerning companies, no one can tell if their order books are reliable, because in every sector, customers cancel their orders or just stop buying, even when prices are discounted, as indicated by dropping retail sales in the past few weeks. And concerning states and municipalities, slumping fiscal revenues are likely to result in even higher deficits and then bankruptcies. As a matter of fact, Russian billionaires, Gulf oil monarchies, Chinese commercial eldorados, all the golden egg geese of companies and financial institutions of the planet, namely European, Japanese, and North American ones, turn out to be insolvent or hardly solvent. The question of the solvency of the U.S. federal, state, and federated states, as well as Russia or the United Kingdom, is beginning to be asked by some big international media, as well as the question of the solvency of large capital-based pension funds, major players in this past 20 years' globalized economy. The trend is clear. The sequence that has begun this year is a sequence of global insolvency. So there you have it. I mean, it is clear, ladies and gentlemen, there is no money left. And there are precious few people willing to lend money. So the governments are going to come in and they're going to create more and more of these ridiculous programs, such as TARP and the bailouts, and they're going to have no effect. Because really, nobody cares. Nobody wants to be involved in your problem or anybody else's problem. You know? Here's a message, by the way, for Ryan, if you're there. I'm hearing from a listener that the signal on PRN keeps fading in and out. The signal keeps stopping, buffering, and continuing to play. Now, Ryan, I don't know whether you can help with this or whether that's the individual listener's problem or one thing or another, but I must bring it to your attention. And I hear that it has nothing to do with us. Mark, take it that basically we are technologically competent and efficient, and it appears that the problem is on your end. All right. Well, let's look at a couple of emails, and then we will proceed. Pamela Summers wrote in and said, she wrote in actually today, late this morning, "Dear Richard, I have a friend who has lost $200,000 in the stock market, even though I gave her your advice over a year ago to sell everything and buy T-bills. Now she feels that prices have gone so low that she's better off just leaving it there rather than selling at such a loss, and wonders what your advice would be in her case." Well, Pamela, it's the same advice that would be in anybody's case. Sell your stocks. Sell your stocks. This is no time to be holding stocks, Pamela. The world is in the most dramatic, disastrous, and devastating drawdown in history. Pamela, I don't know how to put this clearer. If your friend doesn't get the message, all I can tell you is she's going to lose a lot more money. It's up to her, but the message is loud and clear from me, Pamela. Get out of the stock market. And by the way, get out of all your possessions, assets of all kinds. Those of you who are thinking of selling your homes, sell those too. This is a time to hold cash. This is a brutal deflation that is taking place in front of your eyes. Do not delay. Take steps, as we say. Right, we have an email from Jonathan Stokely who says, actually, he says, hi, Gary. I think he means hi, Richard, but who knows? Anyway, did you listen to Obama's speech today? What's your opinion on his stimulus proposal? Do you think it would help or make things worse? He seems to be making it urgent, as they did the financial institutions bailout. All I have to say is, buyer beware. It is really very sad and very pathetic to hear a very brilliant man like Obama spouting out this nonsense, simply because he's being badly advised by incompetent people who have already caused so much damage the world will take decades to recover. And those are the very people to whom he is listening. It is truly sad beyond belief. I think by now, John, you know my opinion on his stimulus proposal, so I don't think I need to go into that. Had a email from Nicodemus Ongoro saying, hi, Martin. It would look like a lot of homeowners, even those who can afford to make the payments, will start giving up their homes when they realize that their home values have greatly depreciated so that they're paying too much for what is greatly undervalued. Are we likely to start seeing this happen? Thanks, Nick. Nick, got news for you. It's been happening now for well over a year. It is happening and it will continue to happen, because people are going to be more and more underwater in their mortgages, and they're just going to keep on, you know, basically paying. They shouldn't, of course, but they are. Well, I do get another listener, Ryan, saying that's true, the signal is breaking up. So it does appear to be a couple of people here with the problem. Anyway, I'm sure that Ryan will do whatever he can to change whatever he might need to change. But in the meantime, he is convinced that the problem is on your side. So, as I say, I'm sure if he finds something, he'll let us know, and I will let you know through the system. He did say his other comment was, it depends on their internet connection. I don't know whether you would like to expound on that a little bit more, Ryan, but somebody called Rodney came in on an email to me saying, buffering problem, I restarted, seems to have worked. So there you are, guys. Try restarting your computer and seeing if that solves the problem. Okie doke. Right. We have now, Bill Bliss also says, I also have intermittent audio. Well, the news so far is that it depends on your internet connection, so see how you can do with that. You may remember we were told on Thursday last that in initial unemployment claims were only 524,000. And, of course, that gave rise to the talking heads, which immediately said that that was proof the economy is simply bad and not falling off a cliff. Well, again, like last week, that seasonally adjusted number masks the real number, which was 952,151. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is correct. There were almost 1 million newly unemployed last week. That is up over 400,000 from the same week in 2008, while the seasonally adjusted number was up only 200,000. Last week, the real number was 726,000, so this is a material rise of over 225,000. Yet the seasonally adjusted number suggests a rise of only 57,000 from last week. The continuing claims data leapt over 500,000 to 5,832,746. The length of time people are staying unemployed is also rising rapidly. We are up almost 1.5 million new continuing claims in just the last 5 weeks. That is a stunning rise of over 30% in unemployment claims in just over a month. We are in completely uncharted territory in terms of the economic landscape. We are boldly going where no man has gone before. It is not a question of whether or not there will be massive stimulus. The question is simply how much and for how long. And I believe it will be far larger than anyone would want to admit today. Let's just set the scene for where we are today. The U.S. likely just experienced a fourth quarter with GDP down over 4%. Some estimates suggest 5%. For all of 2009, we are likely going to be down at least 1 to 2%, which will make this the longest recession since the Great Depression. Unemployment is headed to at least 9%. Consumer spending will be off by at least 3% this year and again in 2010, as consumers start to find virtue in savings, which should rise in the U.S. to 6% within a few years. Housing prices are going to drop another 20 to 30%, taking homes back to a level where they may become more affordable. Corporate earnings are going to be dismal for at least the first two quarters, with forward estimates being lowered again and again. Global trade is falling rapidly, and it is likely that the depression will become global this year. That will result in a further negative feedback on U.S., European, and Japanese exports. The number of defaults is high and rising throughout the developed world. It is likely to be 2011 before the housing market finds a real bottom and housing construction can begin to rise. And that's the very earliest. I think we're going to be 2013 or 2014 before we really see any significant improvement. The credit markets are still in disarray. While there are some signs that the frozen markets are thawing, the Fed and the U.S. Treasury are having to provide more bailout capital to large U.S. banks. Citigroup is breaking up. Bank of America needs massive amounts of capital to digest Merrill Lynch. The hole that is AIG just keeps getting deeper. It's going to take several years for the credit markets to function at anything close to normal as we simply vaporize the whole credit industry worldwide. To think that it will take anything less is simply naive. And in the meantime, the various central banks of the world, along with their governments, are going to step in to fill the need for credit. All right, Frank from New Jersey, you are on the line. How are you?
Hello, Richard.
Hi.
A question for you, two questions actually. One, the group you just quoted that had the global anticipation bulletin, is that something that has a website we can get to?
Yes, actually it is. I quoted them in my talk of the 5th of January in reference to the civic unrest that they predict that's coming down. I'm just looking here to see, because I can't, you know, I don't want to have to read out the whole thing,
right.
But I think the best way you can get to it is by going to www.leap, that's L-E-A-P, 2020.eu.
Okay.
Now, I should try that and see if that works.
Good, thank you. The other question I have for you is in relation to what you're talking about today and have been talking about for a while. And you have stated that things have happened even faster than you could have imagined. So my question is really based on that observation. I'm thinking that in the future we would want to have a mechanism set up that we could transfer funds from banks, local banks, our CDs and maybe IRAs and things, quickly. And I'm thinking we might want to transfer them offshore if we start with nationalizing IRAs and 401ks, or if we start with bank holidays. That's a celebration I don't want to participate in. So I'm thinking I'd want to set up the mechanics where I could quickly say, cash me out, here's an account number someplace. And my question is, do you have any suggestions, given that premise, where we might want to open an account or where we might find out about the mechanics of doing this, opening an account, for instance, Singapore, Switzerland, Norway? I mean, I don't know, and that's my question.
You know, you'll find this hard to believe, Frank, but there was a time when I really thought Iceland was a great place. You know, it was a AAA-rated country. It had excellent bonds. It had a GDP to die for. It had a credit status that was the envy of the world. Look what happened. I mean, the problem, unfortunately, is that, as I said just now, we are wading into uncharted territory here. And it seems to me that the one big difference from the depression of the 30s is that this is now so very globalized. You know, if you'd said to me, if this was, let's say, January of 1930, and you were asking the same question, I could probably have been, you know, clever and told you, well, look, in Sri Lanka, which was, of course, then called Ceylon, there is a bank, excellent bank. It's been around for years and years, and it's as good as it'll ever get, and they've never even heard of the First World, so why don't you transfer your money over there? The problem today is that all of the world is interlinked. And as an aside, I may tell you that that's why it was so pernicious to talk about deleveraging disconnecting from the United States and the rest of the First World, because the whole world is interconnected, as everybody who knows anything knows perfectly well. It was basically the people who wanted to promote, you know, equities in China that were telling you this nonsense. And I refer specifically to people like Peter Schiff, who should have known better. And who really caused a lot of trouble among his clients because of this needless and gratuitous piece of advice. But, the reality is that you cannot escape. The best you can possibly do for the time being is, if you are really completely, totally paranoid about the state of the financial world, keep your money in a mattress under the bed. Other than for that, I like to think that I will be at you before, you know, the real devastation strikes. So, you know, just as I was before. I mean, I gave you plenty of warning about the housing crisis, about the stock market crisis. I mean, I like to think that, you know, my own research enables me to keep a little bit ahead of the situation. But when really the world implodes totally and there's an absolute lockup on all financial markets, I'm afraid at that point that there's no knowing where you can go. The best you can do for the time being, I think, is to go to thestreet.com, find yourself banks which are A-plus rated, and put your money in there. Or else, you know, with the CDs, you're going to be fine. My institution, for example, if you want to make a transfer, it's done the same day. I mean, if provided you call before about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you get your transfer done right then and there. So there shouldn't be a delay, but, hey, these days you really never know. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, Richard.
Meanwhile, Pamela, I am looking at your email, and Ryan, I must tell you again, Pamela tells me I'm breaking up too. The problem is definitely on your end. There's nothing wrong with my internet connection. Right at the moment, it has stopped, though. So it seems to be intermittent. I'm not quite sure what to make of it. Well, what can I say? We got from Andrew an email who says, "Hi, Richard. I picked up a real estate booklet and noticed on a page they listed a number of homes that were sold at $125,000 to $295,000 below their mortgage amount. This is shocking to see this in writing as a proclamation of a calamity. I would think that they would try to hide this info. Thanks for the show, Andrew." Well, thank you very much for the information. Very well received. Thank you. I get from Stowe Stephen, if that's the name, I guess it's Stephen. Once again, thank you, Richard, for your insights and honesty. You have made available enormous amounts of practical information to guide your listeners through these dire economic times. But I hold another vision of what the impending chaos will hold for us. We are, it seems, about to go through a cataclysmic change in values and a complete reorientation of consciousness that will no longer hold the human experience to having and wanting more within this very fragile and fleeting life in form. We are at last going to be confronted with a real assessment of what it is to have been graced with life and the very reason we are here. We are about to be confronted with the true value of this most miraculous moment and the very real need to go within ourselves for a true understanding of our place in it. Perhaps this very dark cloud you have conscientiously informed us of has a very radiant silver lining. Interesting thought there, Stephen. Very interesting. I must say I share your view in a sense. You know, when you've been brought up on a diet of McDonald's and Disney for the better part of your life, it takes some jolt to bring you back to earth and to make you realize that there are more important things in life, you know, than fast food and comics. Not quite sure what that is, and I'm not sure I've ever experienced it, but I'm sure that Mother Nature is going to see to it that we reorganize our priorities in the fullness of time. So anyway, thank you very much for the email. We got the consumer price index numbers last week, and they spelled deflation, in case any of you were under any misapprehension as to whether we're in inflation or deflation. I got a call today from a client asking me if she should be buying the inflation-protected securities. Well, you know, frankly, I don't know where the concept of inflation comes from in anybody's mind these days. And by anybody, I mean those people who like to think that they're experts in economics or economic matters. But I assure you, there is nothing, even remotely on the horizon, that smacks of inflation. Nothing whatsoever. Nothing. Not one single metric that I can point to. I mean, even the money that's being loaned out, even the money that's coming in from the government, it stops right dead in its tracks at the doors of the bank. And if it doesn't go out from the bank, even there's no even remote case to be made for using that as the excuse for inflation. I still maintain that people in positions of knowledge are crying inflation because they know that inflation is so much less pernicious than deflation, and they just don't want people to lose heart, lose spirit, save money, not go out and buy things, and just bring the economy to a halt. And that's exactly what the government is trying to persuade you to do. Barack Obama, with the program that he's going to come in with tomorrow at midday, trying to persuade everybody to spend more money. It's cruel. It's ridiculous. It's criminally insane, as we heard today. It just makes no sense. And if you take my advice, ladies and gentlemen, you will have nothing to do with any of it. You won't buy that new car. You won't buy the house. You know, you won't take that trip that you were supposed to take. It's as simple as that. This is retrenchment time. You know, on an annualized basis, the CPI for the last 3 months was a negative 12.7%. Even core CPI, which is without food and energy, was a minus 0.3%. The CPI for 2008 was just 0.1% for the whole year. This was the smallest calendar year increase since 1954, and it's down from 4.1% from 2007. Central bankers are going to fight tooth and nail any tendency for deflation to catch hold in the economic mind of the country. You know, this $825 billion that Obama wants, which is extra in his stimulus package, in addition to the $350 billion in TARP monies, it's madness. It's just complete nonsense. The Fed has started to buy mortgage assets, and that could be $500 billion or more, which is in addition to some $300 billion plus in growing in commercial paper, in addition to the bank assets, etc. And this is merely the first installment. These problems that I've described are very large. It is one thing to make credit cheap, and yet another to make consumers either want to borrow more or able to convince the lender that borrowers can repay their debts. On one hand, the government is providing capital to the banks and hoping they will lend it. And on the other hand, the regulators are telling them to reduce lending and increase their capital. The commercial mortgages on a mark-to-market basis are imploding. Consumer credit risk is high and rising. What's a bank to do? You know, let's add it up. In the United States, we've seen massive wealth destruction on personal balance sheets. At the end of the third quarter, the losses totaled $5.6 trillion between housing and stocks. They could be over $10 trillion at the end of the fourth quarter. The losses will almost certainly top $12 trillion by the middle of the year as housing continues to deteriorate. Pick any country in the developed world or much of the developing world, and it's the same picture: wealth destruction. We have seen at least $1 trillion of capital on financial companies' balance sheets disappear. And given the recent spate of bailouts, it's going to get much worse. A credit crisis and imploding balance sheets, a housing crisis, and a massive earnings shortfall that yields a relentless stock market drop are all independently deflationary. The combined forces are massively so. To think that a mere trillion or so dollars in stimulus will be enough to reflate the U.S. and the world economies is simply unrealistic. Let me offer a simplistic definition of what I mean by reflation. It's when the velocity of money stops falling for at least two quarters and the economy emerges from outright recession. And you know, much of the proposed stimulus isn't really stimulus. Temporary tax cuts that are not targeted at getting small businesses recharged, which is where the growth in jobs will come from, will likely be saved much in the way that the last stimulus package did little real good for the economy and simply put another $177 billion in debt for future generations to pay. Helping keep people in their homes when they're already head over heels in debt isn't really stimulus, however noble it sounds. Over 50% of mortgages that are reduced and rewritten are delinquent again within 6 months. That does not bode well for future efforts. Better to let the home go at some price to someone who can afford it. Tough love, I'm afraid, but realistic. And by the way, giving money to states to allow them to continue to spend beyond their budgets is not stimulus. And why should the rest of the country pay, for example, for a profligate California? The Robin Hood approach to stimulus programs is non-productive and only encourages bad budgeting habits. Well, my bet is that in the third quarter, when the terrible earnings reports come out and unemployment is over 10% and there is no evidence of a recovery, that we will see yet more stimulus from both the Fed and Congress. Count on it. The Fed and the other central banks are going to step in and be the buyers of last resort for a whole host of debts, both corporate and consumer. There are those who worry about creating inflation because they actually do have to print money to buy these debts. I prefer a world where a central bank doesn't intervene in the markets. The time to fix the problem of excess leverage was a decade ago. Allowing banks to go to 30-to-1 leverage based on value-at-risk models and other financial wizardry that clearly neither the banks nor the regulators understood was simply bad policy, and we are paying for it. As Woody Brock so wisely notes, 30-to-1 leverage is not 3 times more risky than 10-to-1 leverage. It is 25 times more risky. Trust me, the math is correct. And by the way, many European banks were even more highly leveraged. All right. I will have to look at your question again, Michael. It was about the article I read this morning. Johnny Kim, Johnny Kim writes in saying, "Hi, Richard. Thanks for your programs. It's a source of great information. I have two questions. One, you talk about the dollar's coming devaluation. Do you think it's okay to exchange some of my savings and buy yen, or do you think the yen will also go down? Another question. I keep on warning my brother, who has many properties, he's renting them out, but he hasn't paid all the mortgages for them yet. His properties are in New Jersey. He keeps on saying that it's safe. What do you think? Thanks for your answer, Johnny." As about the exchange of your savings into yen, I wouldn't believe that the dollar's necessarily going to collapse immediately. And remember that many other countries also have dire problems as well, Johnny. So don't be so sure that the dollar is suddenly going to collapse. I wasn't sure how I mentioned the dollar's coming devaluation, but I did say that I thought that the dollar would remain stable or even rise for a while yet. So I think your question is somewhat premature. As far as your brother's properties, if he hasn't paid all the mortgages for them yet, I assume he's going to get foreclosed. I'm not quite sure why he thinks it's safe. I don't think I understand your question, but I think he should sell his properties, whether or not he's paid the mortgages and whether or not they're in New Jersey. Johnny, I think he should get out of them immediately, right away, without delay. All right. Mark Bruns comes in saying, "Dear Richard, I read that many people are cashing out of their hedge funds and that their money will be looking for a new home this spring. Have you heard or read the same? What do you think they will invest in? Thanks, Mark." Well, yes, Mark. People are cashing out of hedge funds for the simple reason that every so often these hedge funds refuse to allow redemptions. So they are extremely dangerous investment vehicles, because if you can't get your money out when you want it out, what can you do? You know, I mean, I'm sure that many of these hedge funds, which have closed their doors to redemptions, as soon as they open up, there will be a cascade of money out of them. And by the way, I think this means the end of hedge funds. What use are hedge funds to anybody who can't redeem their money? I mean, this is just not nonsense of the first order. I'm surprised that it's even legal. But what will they invest in, Mark? I have no idea. If they were foolish enough to be in hedge funds, all bets are off, if you ask me. What else do we have? Frank Devlin is also getting the problem of fading, who says, and this is obviously for Ryan's benefit, "I am on FIOZ, F-I-O-Z, by Verizon, if that is any help to the technicians." Well, don't know about that, but Ryan, if you're listening, we have another unhappy customer. Okay, let's take another email that came in earlier, and it comes from Russ, who says, "Hi, Richard, excellent show. I used to listen to so many other podcasts. Now, in the last year, yours has become the most important show over all the others right now. My question has to do with sticking it out here in America. I am certainly not in denial of the conditions of this country, not only about the current financial situation, but have been for years about the environment. It is far from America the beautiful. I have been to many different pristine places, and I have seen so much pollution, and have always been sickened to my stomach to look around. I not only believe you about the violence happening here, I have experienced it. There is already a severe denial in the appreciation of life here. I live in a small town, 50,000, in Virginia, and someone pulled a gun on me, threatening to kill me, because I yelled at his wife, because she almost ran me over as I was jogging in the walking crosswalk, as was my turn with the flow of traffic. I called the police about it, and they don't even care because I wasn't shot. This, to me, is a sign of how insane things already are here. I never threatened to kill someone or hurt someone, but if you get in any type of situation, it just shows me that you have to put up with so much more than we were used to. Threatening to kill someone for yelling at someone shows me how little life is valued here in America, not for all, but a lot. So add in a lost job, no place to live, hunger, police who do not care, a government which also doesn't care, pollution, desperation, and I believe that we're just about at the tipping point of self-implosion. What bothers in part about this is that if you try telling someone about this, they laugh, or most of the time automatically change the subject. There's been many different circumstances which relate to this type of situation, like with Noah. He tried his best to tell people of the floods and rain that was coming, and most didn't make it. I want to make it, but I've absolutely no idea where to go or what to do. I have almost no debt, formal payments with debts. I have some work, and most of our income for me and my family of husband, wife, and three small boys comes from Social Security payments because two of my sons are disabled because of this environment, pollution, poison, vaccines, etc. My payments are $1,300 a month, my rent $300, and other living expenses, which we're able to comfortably live here. But the people around here seem more sickly in the mind than where I came from in New York. So I'm having a hard time believing that we'll be safer in a small town than in a big city. We're willing to go to Canada or to close to the border, but I just don't know what to do. We just won a settlement with SSI where they owe us $10,000 and is not payable in full for 6 months. I've invested a lot of our money in long-term food storage, but I don't feel safe because of the denial that surrounds me here and unwillingness to try to help the situation. What should I do? Best regards, Russ. Russ, I don't know. You know, Jonathan Stokely wrote in saying, "Dear Richard, is it really feasible for, say, millions of Americans to leave the country? Won't countries start closing their doors if they see a lot of Americans applying for green cards? Wouldn't it be more beneficial in the long run for Americans to stay here and form a third or fourth political party that would listen to the citizens and take the necessary measures to solidify the economy?" John, well, you know, as I always say, you know, panic before the rush, ladies and gentlemen. If you are listening to what I have to say, then, frankly, you will know that you must start to think about taking steps. If you are of a mind to leave, you should be thinking about that right now. Now, you don't have to think about cashing in your treasury bills or your CDs. I will tell you when I think you need to do that. But I do think, as I said clearly on the air a couple of weeks ago, that you should be involved in making plans to leave if that is your intent. This is my current advice. So, you know, one way or another, these things must be done. And, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, as always, time comes to an end, and I don't have time to expound on these things, but I will tell you that I never thought in my wildest dreams that I would make a talk such as I made on January the 5th. And for those of you who didn't hear it, it's still on the archives, and you can listen to it again. But I am absolutely sincere, quite sincere about this. You need to take steps immediately if your intention is to leave this country. Otherwise, it will get very hard, just like the writer, the letter writer explained. There will be more and more problems down the line. Thank you very much for your time, ladies and gentlemen. I will be with you again on Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Richard Martin wishing you all a very nice week. Back to work tomorrow, and I'll be with you on Thursday. Bye-bye.